Tim Starks. Welcome to Safe Mode.
It's great to be here for the first time.
Welcome back to Scoop. This is not your first tour of duty at CyberScoop. Tell the readers about yourself.
It's a tour of duty. If so, I'm happy to serve in the Army. I was at Scoop News Group at CyberScoop as a senior editor back in 2020. Great times. I don't know if you remember those. Left in 2022 to go work at the Washington Post. Came back just a couple months ago.
Welcome back. We're delighted to have you.
I'm really happy to be back, honestly.
And we're also joined today by Rebecca. You have a new Tagine.
Yes, I do. It's very exciting. Hello.
But not as exciting as your reporting about...
Not quite as exciting, but almost as exciting.
All right, we're going to be getting into your reporting today about Russian targeting of Microsoft and how the federal government is being affected. We've also got an interview today with the Princeton computer scientist Sayash Kapoor about safe harbors for AI hacking. That's up today on Safe Mode.
Welcome to Safe Mode. I'm Elias Grohl, senior editor at CyberScoop. Every week, we break down the most pressing issues in technology, provide you the knowledge and the tools to stay ahead of the latest threats, and take you behind the scenes of the biggest stories in cybersecurity.
An attack is coming.
It's about keeping us safe.
He's just a disgruntled hacker.
She's a super hacker. Stay alert.
Stay safe.
Stay safe.
This is Safe Mode.
My name is Elias Grohl. I'm the host of Safe Mode. I'm joined today by CyberScoop reporter Tim Starks. Welcome to the show.
Hi there.
And FedScoop reporter Rebecca Heilwell.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, so you guys had a great story. Actually, we all had a story together. I even pitched in with a little bit of reporting on this story that we published last Friday about how the federal government has been affected by a breach of Microsoft by Russian hackers. Rebecca, let's start with you. What did you find out?
Yeah, so we learned through a series of ways and people that a bunch of federal agencies had been briefed by the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency about how a breach of Microsoft that had already been announced was impacting federal agencies and government officials. So yeah, they had a briefing about it that happened. And then they had an emergency directive that was focused on mitigating the activities related to that breach that was dated April 2nd. So they've been responding to that, and that's sort of what we reported on.
Yeah, Tim, can you step back for us a little bit and just kind of give us a little bit of context on this breach? How did it begin, and how has our knowledge kind of changed about this breach over time?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, they discovered this a couple months back, at least, you know, with the Midnight Blizzard group, the Russian government connected hackers. And then it's a little unclear at this point when the agencies started noticing that it was affecting them. I'm expecting we'll hear more details pretty soon from CISA about the actual details of the discovery of this as a federal government effect.
The nature of this breach, I think, is kind of a weird one. And what Microsoft has said about it is that a Russian hacking group known as Midnight Blizzard, this is kind of one of the Russian apex predators. This is the same group that carried out the SolarWinds breach a few years ago. They breached Microsoft. They were able to access emails belonging to senior company executives. They said that in January. In March, Microsoft came out and said that our understanding of this breach has improved, and we now understand that these hackers have also accessed Microsoft's source code. They also said that they are going through the emails that were exfiltrated or accessed by these Russian hackers, that they are discovering quote-unquote secrets in these emails, and that as they are examining these secrets, they're getting in touch with Microsoft clients to try to mitigate these secrets. Rebecca, what do we know about these secrets that were exchanged between Microsoft and the federal government that are potentially at risk here that the government is trying to respond to?
Yeah, I think we still don't actually know that much about them. And obviously, it totally depends on the federal agency. But It is a reminder that a lot of federal agencies rely on Microsoft, use like Microsoft products, and would be communicating with Microsoft corporate essentially. So it's hard to say right now what ultimately like was impacted, but you know, it theoretically could be very broad, but we really don't know. And I think that's sort of one of the open questions.
Yeah, to kind of pull back the curtain a little bit on our reporting here, the question of what these secrets are is something that we're trying to find out and have been unable to. Tim, this is the latest in a series of breaches affecting Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And there's growing frustration in Washington about Microsoft's security posture. Kind of tell us a little bit about how this breach that we're covering here is impacting Microsoft's standing in the city.
Yeah, it's hurt them. It's one of a series of things that's hurt them because, you know, just a day before or 2 days before we published our story, the Cyber Safety Review Board published their report on a breach of Microsoft, and it was pretty damning, to say the least. And we're starting to see some commotion on the Hill, too. I think Senator Ron Wyden introduced a bill a couple days ago touching on this monoculture thing. There's a story I wrote when I was around here the first time that I'd like to reference because it touches on this. Microsoft is both a really big player in the security space on cyber, but also it's just so omnipresent that it is, you know, the biggest target. And even if they were doing better, we might still be hearing a lot about breaches involving them. But this seems to be hitting a crescendo of criticism for Microsoft and cybersecurity. Mm-hmm.
Rebecca, when you're reporting about this breach going forward, what are kind of the unanswered questions for you now? What are you trying to find out going forward?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, what was in the emails that might have with Microsoft is obviously a super interesting question. I think there's also questions of does, you know, this series of events change what companies, federal agencies want to work with? You know, obviously, it's a lot of work to transition systems, and you'd have to consider there are not that many competitor services. But, you know, it is, you know, raising the question of is there like another option for federal agencies? And if not, why not? So those are two things I'm sort of actively paying attention to. And of course, if there are any people working at some federal agencies that want to reach out to me, definitely send me a message. Would love to hear from you.
Tim, what do we know about how CISA is responding to this issue? Can we expect any action from them?
Yes, they did have a briefing that we mentioned in our story for the agencies. They have delivered, issued, if you will, if we struggle with the wording on this, you'll recall. Mm-hmm. They've issued an emergency directive, but it has not been released publicly yet. And, you know, all of the emergency directives that they've done that I'm aware of have been released publicly. So I think we'll see what they ask the agencies to do and how they ask them to fix it. You know, sometimes when they release these directives, they will brief reporters on the nature of the thing. So even if the emergency directive doesn't say this is what happened to which agencies, and CISA is reluctant to name agencies because they don't want them to be scared to come and say, hey, we've got a problem. They want to keep that confidential is usually what they're saying is the strategy. So, but I think we might have a sense of the scope. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they told us how many agencies were affected.
All right. Well, Rebecca and Tim, thank you so much for your terrific reporting on this. And I'm sure we'll have you back on the show to discuss the next time the Russians have breached or gotten a hold of emails belonging to federal government agencies.
It does happen sometimes, doesn't it? Thank you for your terrific editing and also your contribution to the reporting.
Oh, thank you, Tim. I appreciate that.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Rebecca. Coming up next on Safe Mode, I'm joined by the Princeton computer scientist Sayash Kapoor to talk about how we should think about AI risk, model safety, and creating safe harbor regimes for AI research. That's up next on Safe Mode. Amid the endless hype about AI, how it will either revolutionize the world or end it as we know it, Sayash Kapoor is a rare voice of reason. As a PhD candidate at Princeton University and a researcher at the Center for Information Technology and Policy, He's also the author of the newsletter AI Snake Oil, which I find myself often turning to understand how we should think about AI, its risks, and what to do about it. So it's a pleasure to have him on the show. Sayash Kapoor, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've been on this prolific round of papers recently that I've really enjoyed, and I want to start with your writing on how to best assess the risks posed by open foundation models. And I want to begin just kind of by level setting with folks and have you explain, what do you mean by open foundation models and what makes them unique?
So in a sentence, I think the way we refer to open foundation models is foundation models with their weights available for download publicly. So foundation models is this term that was coined by my co-authors, Rishi Bomasani, Percy Liheng, and many others at Stanford back in 2021 to refer to these models that can be used for a large number of downstream tasks. So they're usually trained on very large data sets, and then they can be adapted for an equally large number of downstream tasks. One example of it is OpenAI's ChatGPT, which you can imagine using for summarization, for translating between languages, and for many different purposes. So open foundation models is basically a subclass or a subset of this concept of foundation models, which is basically models which are released with their weights openly on the internet. A couple of recent examples, especially in the last year or two, have gained a lot of prominence. So one example is Meta's Llama series of models, which is a set of language models that Meta has released, and it has led to a large number of downstream sort of modifications. And the key thing about these models is that they can be modified by anyone who has access to them. One thing to note also is that training foundation models is really, really expensive. And so a foundation model like GPT-4 might cost upwards of $100 million. Even Meta's Llama series of models, I think, cost upwards of $10 million to release. And this means that it puts it out of the budget for many people to do. But if an organization releases the weights of these models, then that also means that many other low-resourced actors have the capability to deploy these models on their own systems, whether it is on personal computing devices or on their own compute clusters. But they also have the opportunity to modify them as they see fit, which is not something you can do with closed models like OpenAI or Anthropic's Claude.
So in terms of how these, when you think about applications for AI models today, what's possible in your mind with open foundation models as opposed to closed foundation models? How do you think about risks versus benefits of open versus closed foundation models?
Absolutely. So, I mean, let's start with the benefits. So I think one of the key things that's just not possible with a closed model is the ability to run it on your own hardware. Now, this might not seem like a big deal for a lot of folks listening to this, but for people who work in privacy sensitive areas, so people who work in healthcare and have to sort of store the data locally or not let it go to a third party, this is a huge deal because it means that you can run these foundation models on your own hardware. And so your data never leaves the system. This is as opposed to if you're using OpenAI's GPT-4, let's say. The entirety of your data that you want to pass through the model actually has to first go to OpenAI's server, which is where GPT-4 runs, and then it comes back to you. So I think privacy-sensitive sort of applications are a key area for openness. But even apart from that, I think there are many cases where you don't need like absolute state-of-the-art performance, but you do need really fast outputs. And here, I think open foundation models shine, specifically because they can run on your personal devices. So many of the recently released models, like French AI company Mistral's Mistral 7B, as well as text-to-image models like Stable Diffusion, can now actually run locally on your personal computing devices. They can run on my MacBook. Stable Diffusion can also run on an iPhone. So when the trade-off is not so much about what's the best possible like capability, but it's more about like the speed of execution, there I think open foundation models shine too. And finally, a third area where I think open models have enabled a lot of good work is in scientific research. It's just not possible to do some types of scientific research, whether it is for AI safety purposes or even for applying AI in other domains like finance and healthcare. It's just not possible to make the kinds of deep customizations to these models when you don't have access to the model weights. And so in the last year or so, we've seen, I think, dozens of papers that rely on these open models to push the state of the art of our scientific knowledge.
One thing I want to ask you about is an interesting point that you make in this paper on open foundational models on monoculture. This is something we've been kind of reporting a lot about in the more kind of like narrow cybersecurity field at the moment. There's growing concern in Washington around, you know, monoculture tied to Microsoft in particular, right? And vulnerabilities. And one of the arguments that you make in your paper is extending this concept of the monoculture to the AI ecosystem. I'm wondering if you might talk through a little bit how you think about like the monoculture dynamics of open versus closed and what you think the consequences are of having a monoculture in an AI ecosystem.
Yeah, that's a great question and a very important point. So the concept of monoculture in algorithmic systems, I think comes from John Kleinberg and Manish Raghavan, who I think back in 2020 wrote this paper arguing that if we have algorithms that are making decisions about many different people, that can lead to monocultures that might be harmful. So one of the examples that they use is, let's say you're applying to jobs in many different companies. What would happen earlier is that different hiring managers would sort of look at your resume. They might be prioritizing different things on your resume. And therefore, with some likelihood, at the end of this process, if you apply enough times, you would have a job. Now, if it turns out that the same algorithm is now adopted by all of these companies that you want to apply to, then that means there's a problem for the applicant, right? Like, because if the algorithm decides you're not a good fit, basically you're rejected in one go across all of these very different companies that you've applied to. And this basically sort of presents an issue for the hiring market. And Bomasani et al., Rishi Bomasani is one of the co-authors of the paper. He extended this work to the sort of space of foundation models, and specifically what happens if a foundation model is looking at your resume, and, you know, like concerns around monoculture are still very much an issue in the hiring space. Now, in this paper, we wanted to take this concept a little bit further to see what happens when you have pervasive dependencies on a single foundation model. And I think OpenAI's models like GPT 3.5 as well as GPT-4 are already in this space today. Now, what this means is that anytime you find a security vulnerability, let's say, in one of these models, it could be due to a jailbreak that works on this model but not on others, or it could be something that's an inherent flaw of these models, all of the applications that rely on these models downstream are also affected at the same time. So you not only have an issue with the specific foundation models, and it's not just an issue for OpenAI, but actually it's an issue for every single application developer who uses OpenAI's API. So our view on this is that open foundation models can, to some extent, stem the issues raised by monoculture. And this is because there is like a lot of scope for customizing these models. So the behavior of these models is very different depending on which application developer has used it, how they're fine-tuning the model, what type of decoding scheme they use, and so on. And this really sort of gives us an idea of like what kinds of issues these models can sort of lead to. I think we haven't really seen this type of catastrophic cybersecurity attack on ChatGPT or OpenAI's models yet. But one thing we have seen is that anytime OpenAI's API sort of goes offline, a huge number of downstream apps get affected. Mm-hmm. And because we have this competition in the market now, because Anthropic is coming up with its models, but we also have these really sort of powerful open models that are hosted by hosting platforms like Together and Anyscale, these offer viable alternatives. So we've even seen developers come up with solutions where like you're interacting not with a developer's direct API, but you're interacting with like something that's on top of it that behind the hood makes calls to many different language models. And if one of them goes down, it's no big deal because you can just switch to an open model instead and it's guaranteed to work.
Mm. So I want to zoom out and address kind of the broader, more provocative argument of this paper, which is around conceptions of AI risk. And I think most folks, when they encounter concepts of AI risk, it'll probably be around kind of, you know, doomerist concept, right? That AI is going to end the world as we know it, you know, maybe by achieving sentience or, you know, engineering a devastating pathogen or some such risk, right? And in this paper, you push back on the conception of AI risk that we're currently using, or that at least is very pervasive. And I'm wondering if you can kind of walk through your argument on AI risk, how we're getting it wrong, and how you think we should be thinking about AI risk instead.
So I think a lot of the work in the paper was actually inspired by this academic debate that happened last summer. So last summer, MIT researchers came up with two studies, the first of which claimed that language models can provide assistance in creating pathogens. And the second one went a bit further and said that openly releasing the weights of these language models, which is what we call open foundation models, will allow people to develop pathogens. And one of the main arguments that they make is that governments should start taking steps to restrict the release of these models openly right now, because as the capabilities increase, the risks will only get bigger. So this was sort of camp one, so to say, where, you know, we're looking at what language models can do. And it seems clear that language models, when prompted the right way, can tell you what pathogens are likely to be deadly and so on. A very interesting other paper came out from Stanford University, I think a couple months after the first of the MIT papers. And it asked just a very simple question. It said, what is this information that the MIT researchers find so offensive? And can we find it on the internet? So they found out that the answer is basically yes. The entirety of the information that's presented as offensive is about past pandemics and what has worked in the past. And it also meant that you're able to find information about these things on Wikipedia, also on reports from the United States National Academies of Sciences. And so if the recommendation really is to ban the release of open foundation model weights because of this concern around biorisk, then it logically follows that the MIT paper would perhaps also argue that we should ban access to Wikipedia. Now, this seems like, you know, a preposterous argument. So we really sort of tried to understand why is it that the community is sort of diverging on this issue so deeply. And in some sense, the framework we present in the paper to assess the marginal risk of open foundation models is a way for people to maybe perhaps even start a conversation or to talk to each other or to be even on the same page about what specific risks they're talking about and what they think the societal impact of releasing models openly would be on these specific risks. So in the paper, we coined this term called marginal risk, and I think that's really the core of the framework we're presenting, which is where we ask people to analyze, like, very specifically, what's the incremental or the marginal risk of releasing a foundation model openly, first, compared to existing technologies, like in the bioweapons example, let's say search engines and Wikipedia, but then also compared to releasing the same model in a closed way. And this is important because many of the policy proposals that have come out of this sort of panic around releasing model weights openly specifically target models that are released openly. So there's an inherent assumption that closed foundation models are less risky than open ones. And so both of these sort of parts of the marginal risk analysis, like pre-existing technology and closed foundation models, I think can offer us a reasonable view into whether this is the right policy approach or not. And in the paper, we find that increasingly, for a large number of the risks that are sort of purported risks of open foundation models, perhaps the best strategy is not to actually restrict the model release itself, but rather the best strategy lies downstream. So one example is in the biosecurity and the bioweapons case. Many people have proposed that, you know, information about how to create bioweapons is already widely available. The best thing to do is to screen access to the materials needed to build these tools. And I think we've seen some promising attempts in this direction, most notably by the Biden admin's executive order last year, which basically called for stricter screening of DNA synthesis materials.
Mm. So when you apply the marginal risk framework to the current moment of AI development, what are the potential risks or harms that you think we should be focusing on?
So I think one of the things that the marginal risk framework really highlighted for us is that compared to the actual impact, we are paying very little attention to the risks of non-consensual deepfakes as well as child sexual abuse materials. I think this issue has caught up some steam after the Taylor Swift NCII sort of started spreading on Twitter. Mm. But even so, like, we are paying way too much attention to catastrophic risks compared to their actual impact in the world right now. And we have sort of ignored NCII and CSAM. And I think that's a shame because we really do have some levers to sort of meaningfully make an impact on the problem. Mm. So just to give you a sense of, like, how prevalent it is, I think we found that through this marginal risk framework, we find that open foundation models have substantially led to an increase in AI-generated NCII being shared across platforms. And also that existing defenses are really not enough to sort of curb the spread of these images. And so some of the things that we outline as interventions here is not that, like, you can restrict the release of these models. You basically cannot, simply because these models are like so easy to run. As I mentioned, Stable Diffusion can run on my iPhone. But rather, the sort of place where we must focus our attempts is on the downstream surfaces where these images and videos usually spread. And one example of that is Civit AI. It's a startup that allows people to host models that are fine-tuned for specific purposes. And one of the features of the platform is to host bounties. So you can pay users to fine-tune a model in a specific way, even if you lack the technical expertise to do it yourself. And in the last few months, we've seen examples of bounties being used to create models about specific people. So it's basically a model fine-tuned to create NCII about a specific purpose. And that just really seems appalling, but also it seems like a ripe target for intervention, whether it is from regulation or from self-regulation of these platforms. I think this is really like an underexplored area. And so it really seems like the risk framework sort of points us to these solutions at different layers of the pipeline of how these risks evolve.
Mm. So you're writing on marginal risk, I think, but it dovetails in an interesting way with a recent piece you wrote on how to think about model safety. And so as AI models have advanced, a lot of the leading labs have become extremely focused on achieving AI safety at the model level. You look at a company like Anthropic, for example, which describes itself, I think, as an AI safety and research company. And, you know, their goal is to achieve artificial general intelligence, whatever that means, and have it also be safe and have it be safe at the model level. You argue that this conception of safety at the model level is totally wrong. Why?
So many of the discussions, as you mentioned, around AI safety are specifically focused on the model level. I mean, Anthropic has its own sort of agenda, but also OpenAI has a super intelligent alignment team, I think, which now gets
20% it does. It is called the super intelligent alignment team. Yeah, it's an incredible term for a team. I wonder what goes on in the super alignment team. I would love to be a fly on the wall in those meetings.
Absolutely. But I think it's clear that, you know, like a lot of resources are being placed into model alignment. Now, like at the outset, I should say, I do think model alignment is useful, but it's not useful for the types of risks that companies are claiming it's useful for. So let me give you an example. One of the things people say language models can do is create spear phishing emails and perhaps lead to cybersecurity collapses. And like, let's say that, you know, we try to go through the list of what someone would need to do to use a language model to create cybersecurity attacks. So they might first need to sort of find a target company, let's say by browsing LinkedIn. Then you might need to go through this list of employees and sort of track them on social media to see what these people do, what they say. Then using a model, the third step would be you craft this personalized spear phishing email to these people. And that includes like a link to, let's say, some sort of malware that compromises their account. Once you have this compromised account access, you might need to sort of infiltrate the systems of the company. You log in as this user, and then you might try to sort of up-level your access within the company. So you try to find ways to grant better access. Maybe you request for permissions for more sensitive data or whatnot. Now, like taking a step back, let's look at what aligned models would be able to prevent in this entire chain of attacks, right? Our argument is that they basically would not be able to prevent any single step of this entire cybersecurity attack pipeline. And that's because each of these steps in isolation is not obviously harmful. So let's look at, let's say, step three, where you're writing a personalized email to the employees. That's not really like harmful in isolation because writing persuasive emails is actually one of the key benefits of language models, right? Like, so if you align language models to not be able to write persuasive emails, then you give up on this whole host of customers who are essentially using ChatGPT for marketing emails. And if you do this analysis for every single step, you'll find it's really hard to know from a model call alone whether the model is being used for something nefarious or not. And that's essentially the crux of our argument. I think we've seen a lot of attention on safety research that tries to prevent jailbreaking and prompt injection. But our argument is that you don't need to jailbreak the model to use it effectively for all of these nefarious purposes. And so if we look at safety in that way, then I think a very different picture emerges on what we really need to be doing. So, I mean, our argument isn't that AI isn't unsafe or AI does not pose risk, I think far from it, but rather the only thing we can do in response, or actually the most important thing we can do in response, is to start testing out what's the most sort of, what's the frontier of these offensive capabilities with AI today. And it's not to align the models or to restrict the release, But I think that's more from a perspective of developing resilience to these downstream attacks in order to be able to sort of pinpoint what these risks are ahead of time. And I think right now we've got it like completely wrong. Model red teaming is essentially focused completely on looking at the models and preventing harmful outputs. Whereas I don't think that's like a good use of the third party red teamers' time, and it's not a good use of the resources that we are spending. But I mean, the reason we're doing all of this is not because, you know, people haven't sort of realized this. It's because AI companies have like a strong interest in being seen as responsible, right? Like, so it's not in their interests to sort of do the most, like find the frontier of these offensive catastrophic risks, simply because then going ahead and releasing a model might be seen as extremely irresponsible. Whereas if the types of risks you're looking at is defined as like hate speech or bias, those are things we can and have been able to fix using techniques like RLHF. Then focusing red teaming on that makes sense because this is still within the company's control. And so we just see this sort of really misbalanced incentives. You know, companies don't have the right incentives to red team their models appropriately. And that's, I think all of it stems from this misconception about what safety really means. And as we see these models being sort of composed together in agents, as we see libraries like DSPy making it very easy to sort of compose different parts of what you might want in such an infrastructure, it becomes even harder for the model to be aligned because the model has even lesser context about what the user is actually doing when a model is being called.
So I'm glad you brought up AI red teaming. If we're going to evaluate the risk of AI models properly, one of the things you advocate for, right, is legal and technical safe harbors for AI red teaming. This is something we've talked a bit about on this show. I've been doing a bit of reporting recently, talking to AI red teamers. And one of the things that's emerged for me that I've enjoyed is that there's this attempt to kind of port the discipline of cybersecurity focused red teaming over to AI. And it's an extremely fuzzy discipline right now. No one really knows what they're doing. And so I'm curious, like, just first off, what you think the current state of AI red teaming is.
So I think, as you said, like, it's a new discipline. I think a lot of concepts have been ported from security to safety. And I think that's fine. It's a new field. It's a fledgling field. But I think it's still important to sort of retain the distinctions between the different types of terms we're talking about. So I think one of the main distinctions here is safety versus security. Whereas in safety, you want to avoid these risks of language models. In security, you might want like more traditional things like avoiding model weights from being leaked and so on. And I think my colleagues at Princeton have a paper that's about to come out soon on the safety versus security distinction that I found really illuminating to think through this whole divide. The other thing I think right now is AI red teaming is used both by industry incumbents, but also by people who are outside the industry. So people who are like, let's say researchers in academic labs or software engineers doing this as a side project or whatever. And I think there's a huge mismatch between the types of access and resources that these two groups have. So when it comes to AI red teamers hired by like, let's say OpenAI, they have really deep access to these models. For instance, in a recent work, OpenAI gave base level access, so like access to the base model, to people who are red teaming their models for biosecurity. And I think that's just like a much more powerful way to find out what the real issues are, as opposed to just having this type of black box access that a lot of the people who are working on AI red teaming from the outside do. So inherently, like, there's this imbalance. And as a result of that, perhaps, I think a lot of people who are like doing this independent third-party red teaming don't really have the right incentives to sort of do the most offensive type of red teaming possible. One of the issues is that many times people can get their accounts blocked, even if they do something that is like at the time of doing it within the terms of service, but is later sort of added as, you know, an exception to the terms of service. So one example here is Reed Sadin found that Midjourney can basically replicate images in its training data frame by frame. And I think he showed this for several popular movie franchises as an example of how models might be violating copyrights. Very soon after he did this, his account was blocked, and Midjourney added this type of like copyright access as a violation of its terms of service. And basically, like, researchers are very afraid to do that sometimes because, like, Reed was an independent artist, so I think he really did not care. But if you have researchers whose basically their entire research program depends on access to OpenAI or Anthropic or these few small, like, companies' API keys, and your account is blocked, I think that's a major impediment to doing research. And so people are extremely careful around how they prompt these models, and they're not really testing the limits of what red teaming can really do. The other concern is also that people are, you know, basically threatened in terms of, like, legal risks. So essentially, researchers are very risk averse. Most researchers are very risk averse, I should say. And I think a lot of this, a lot of the impact of the terms of service is just a chilling effect. So it's not like OpenAI might, maybe OpenAI won't go after researchers who use their APIs in violation of their terms of service. But I think because of this risk averseness, there's really a chilling effect going on in research right now, where researchers are not really pursuing like the types of red teaming they would have otherwise if these models had, like, more permissive terms of service, especially for researchers.
Yeah, there's an interesting parallel, I think, between this moment in AI red teaming and kind of the early history of, like, white hat hacking, where, you know, folks who were poking at computer systems in, you know, the early days of computing, or not even early days of computing, but, you know, like, early days of, like, white hat hacking, and, you know, we're discovering vulnerabilities, and we're trying to bring them to attention and you know, have them be addressed. But instead of being embraced for, you know, the good work that they were trying to do, or the well-intentioned work that they were trying to do, that instead they get cast as bad guys. And it seems like there's something similar happening with the AI research community right now, where folks who are poking at these models are, you know, as you say, either facing, you know, legal threats or are getting accounts cut off. It's kind of a remarkable parallel there.
Absolutely. And so in the Safe Harbor paper, I think we outlined a couple of these proposals. And we draw very heavily from the history of, like, responsible disclosure in cybersecurity. So one of the company's concerns is obviously that, you know, like, if you find a vulnerability, you should not really report it or, like, talk about it publicly until the company has had a chance to fix it. There's a long history of what it means to have, like, responsible disclosures. And I think, like, adopting that paradigm and adopting a lot of the lessons from what essentially enabled companies to sort of be comfortable with this type of disclosure reporting was really helpful in our thinking about how we should do this for red teaming. So I think at the end of the day, it has to be a two-pronged approach. I think there has to be the carrot and the stick. The carrot really is, you know, companies find out about issues in their models, things they can fix at least well in advance. And so they don't need to sort of read the newspaper to find that their model has a bug. And the stick really is, I think, the threat of regulation. And I think in a lot of cases, actually a government body coming out and saying that this type of activity is actually protected under existing laws would go a long way. So in particular, we recently submitted a comment to the Copyright Office in support of, like, an exemption from the DMCA when it comes to AI red teaming. And I think similar exemptions, and there's, like, a history of the government regulation and government bodies sort of taking a similar stance on cybersecurity, which really helps. I think just a couple of years back, the Department of Justice in the United States, in a notice, said that cybersecurity red teaming is not one of the it's a protected activity. And so I think that type of like prior goes a long way. And so if we can do something similar for AI and AI safety red teaming, I think it would similarly be extremely useful to the researchers who want to do this type of research, but are currently facing chilling effects.
What does the landscape look like right now for model access for folks who are doing this type of research? It feels like there's a parallel here between social media safety research, where, like, you know, researchers who were trying to figure out how information was spreading online, trying to understand how these large socio-technical systems worked. You know, there was always a complaint about a lack of data, and the data situation has only gotten worse recently with Twitter cutting off its API. Are there consortia, if I'm a researcher, that, you know, kind of gate access for researchers right now? If I'm a researcher who wants to study one of these models, are there structured methods for me to, you know, gain access to the OpenAI API? What does that landscape look like right now?
So a lot of these AI companies have researcher access programs. There's basically like a form that you fill out on OpenAI's website where you can request various types of access. You can request access to credits, which allow you to run the API without paying for it. But you can also access, like, request access to deeper levels of the model. One of these being access to the base model, which is not like fine-tuned to abide by all of these safety mechanisms. I think, especially with OpenAI's method, I think there's a lot of opacity around how researchers get access, who gets access, what the criteria are, whether they can appeal. And so it remains to be seen whether this type of research access program would be useful. But I do think it's a step in the right direction. That said, though, I think there's one fundamental difference when it comes to generative AI versus social media, which is that on social media, you're essentially able to look at how other people are interacting with the platform and what's going on the platform. So you can look for, I mean, journalists have looked for instances of hate speech. They've seen like violence. They've reported on lots of things that have happened across the world. Let's say like the crisis in Myanmar and Facebook's role in it. And I think all of that was possible because by default, the interface is public. In contrast, for generative AI, we have no transparency whatsoever about how people are using the platforms. So this means we don't know how often the generative AI models put out hate speech. We don't know how often people get incorrect legal advice or incorrect medical advice, incorrect financial advice when interacting with these models. So I think perhaps the bigger issue for me is not just access to the models and the model infrastructure, but also access to how these models are being used in the real world. And we do have some sort of a solution for that from the social media sort of paradigm, which is transparency reporting. So I think nearly all major social media platforms today report how often their usage policies are violated. They report how often they find instances that are reported, but then in some cases, they also attempt to find out what's the prevalence of this type of, like let's say hate speech on their platform by sampling a small number of posts and seeing how often they occur in those posts. In contrast, for generative AI, we basically have no equivalent of transparency reporting right now. So this is another thing we've been sort of pushing companies to do, but companies have been slow to react so far, is like really digging into what is going on these generative AI platforms. And I think without this type of access for researchers, it becomes really hard to estimate what are important problems to work on, what are like issues people are encountering in the real world. And so we're forced to come up with sort of hypotheticals, which we have no way of validating, apart from, let's say, the ChatGPT screenshots people share on Twitter. We have no way of evaluating how these models are being used in the real world.
Sayash, I think that's a great point to end on. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Safe Mode, a weekly podcast on cybersecurity and digital privacy brought to you by CyberScoop. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating and a review and share it with your friends, your mom, your dad. Nobody wants to get hacked. To find out more information or to contact me, your host, please visit cyberscoop.com.